Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to The Love Code. This is such a wonderful show because it is all about inspiring you to really be the best you can be, to connect with the true power that you are, to open your hearts, to really step into the greatest expression of who you are in this lifetime. And as always, these conversations are so inspirational, they're uplifting, they're healing, and most of all, helping to really connect you to the truth of who you are. And as always, I have a great guest and a great conversation ahead. I do want to say, first of all, and this is probably the last time I'll be announcing it because the window of opportunity is closing, but I am organizing a small group of people to go to one of the most extraordinary countries on the planet, and that is the very unique country of Bhutan. Bhutan is, if you haven't heard of it, most people kind of know the name, but they don't know where it is. It's nestled between India, China, Sikkim is on the left side of it, you're looking on the map, and it's a country steeped in Buddhism, in compassion, in gratitude, in ancient wisdom, temples that are thousands of years old. There are temples in India where ascended masters have been, just reading about this yesterday, have actually arrived at a place of becoming so aware, so connected, so ascended that they have been able to, this is hard to believe, but they have been able to change matter, and they left their handprints and footprints as they dissolve the illusion of matter as being solid. And that's in Bhutan. There are places in Bhutan where you can actually see their footprints. So extraordinary a place. So anyway, October 19th through 31st, I'll be taking a small group. It's just going to be a small group, a very small group of people. We have a few places left to come and experience a truly profound, magical, transformative journey into another world, another dimension, and have a lot of fun. So if you are interested, if you're curious, if you just are wanting to check it out, two ways to do that. Go to the website cyprushimalaya.com, which is the tour group that's organizing this amazing trip, or you can contact me directly. And the best way to do that is to just go to message me on my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know. It's probably the best place to go, What Women Must Know. You can message me, and I can send you some information. But anyway, we have to get everything organized and deposits down the next few weeks. So it's a great opportunity, and like I said, that window is closing for this trip. So that's the big announcement that I want to share with you today, and we're going to just jump right into my guest and the conversation today. We're going to be talking about the topic of a new book. It's called Long Walk Out of the Woods, and it's subtitled A Physician's Story of Addiction, Depression, Hope, and Recovery with my guest, Dr. Adam Hill. And this is such a great inspirational conversation and great book. And I just want to share with you a quote on the front of the book by Dr. Eben Alexander, who has been a guest on my show several times. He's a neurosurgeon and best-selling author. And he has left this quote on the book. It's, "This book is a wake-up call not only for the medical profession, but for our culture at large." This is a big journey, a big story, a big healing process, and I'm so happy to welcome Dr. Adam Hill to the show. And before I bring him on, I just want to share his bio. So Dr. Hill is a palliative care physician at Riley Hospital for Children. Dr. Hill is a proud Hoosier, a Butler Bulldog, and a IUSM graduate. He completed his pediatric residency training at St. Louis University, a fellowship in pediatric hematology, oncology at Duke University, and a palliative medicine fellowship at IUSM. He works in palliative care and is focused on allowing patients to live the best quality of life possible in the midst of chronic, life-limiting and or life-threatening medical conditions. In addition to palliative care, Dr. Hill is passionate about physician wellness, self-care, physician education, and international medical work. His international work has allowed him to work in Belize, Mexico, Kenya, Tanzania, and Australia over the past several years. In addition, as part of his work in palliative care, he serves as the medical director for a week-long summer camp for children affected by childhood cancer. Dr. Hill is passionate about physician wellness and self-care in the context of changing the culture of medicine surrounding mental health conditions and addiction. In 2017, Dr. Hill published a groundbreaking New England Journal of Medicine article titled Breaking the Stigma, A Physician's Perspective on Self-Care and Recovery. In this article and his lectures, Dr. Hill shares his own story of personal recovery from depression and substance use. As a result, Dr. Hill has become a national recognized lecturer on the topic, including his latest book and his most recently released book. It's been out for the last 2 months, called Long Walk Out of the Woods. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Adam Hill to the show today. So hello and welcome, Adam.
Thank you for having me. Privileged to be with you today.
Yeah, it's so wonderful. I've really been going through your book, and you did a great job, by the way. Congratulations. It's always quite an achievement to be able to write a story, especially being so honest about your own. And you have quite a story to share and quite a teaching tale to offer us, Adam. So first of all, I just want to thank you for your courage and being able to talk about your journey and to be out there. And I know it wasn't easy to get to this point, but I really want to thank you for that courage, because it makes such a difference in other people's lives to hear one's own personal story, especially coming back from the darkness.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. That means a lot, and I really hope, and you know, in opening up and sharing this, that it'll find somebody that needs to hear this message.
Exactly. So let's begin by telling your story. So share with us the journey that you have been on, and this healing path that has become your healing path. It has become really a great purpose in life, but let's start at the beginning. What was the process that took you into the world of addictions, and then we can talk about how you emerged from it.
Sure, I really write this story as a human story and a one of a human experience that I think so many people have common threads of lives that have been touched by mental health, depression, anxiety, addiction, whether personally or somebody you love or somebody that's close to you. And so, you know, I don't write this story as a physician, but just as somebody whose life has been touched by these conditions and somebody who day by day tries to figure a path out of the darkness. And, you know, my story starts not unlike a lot of other people. I was raised in a small town at a loving family. I struggled early in my youth with some bullying and never feeling like I really fit in or belonged. I had a lot of social anxiety early in my youth, and for many years really sort of tried to mask that insecurity and inferiority I felt inside by pouring myself out, by achieving at high levels. If I could achieve on the athletic field or in the classroom, then I didn't have to disclose what I was really struggling with as somebody who felt introverted and shy and alone and different. And that coping mechanism worked for me for many years, which turned into decades as a high achiever and allowed me opportunities to, you know, study hard in college while working two jobs to get into medical school. But all along that path of masking what I was struggling with inside, which was, you know, pretty complex feelings and emotions that I continued to hide away. Early in medical school, then I tied my identity to this high achievement, the, you know, smartest person in my classroom or highest achiever on test scores or getting into medical school. And then this abrupt recalibration that happened when I went into medical school and realized that I was no longer even the smartest person sitting in my classroom row and felt invalidated almost overnight and didn't have any other identity other than that. And so when that identity was shattered, I started to fall deeper into depression, but didn't have a lot of self-awareness into what I was struggling with. I just continued to grind through medical school, studying 16, 18 hours a day, doing what I was supposed to do and tying my identity to, you know, to being a future doctor. And that was the light at the end of the tunnel. And if I worked hard, delayed gratification, continued to push, then one day eventually I would be happy. And, you know, that I'd had that mindset for so long that and not really knowing what I was dealing with my emotions, and then started to really struggle with depression. And it wasn't until the end of medical school when I actually had a physical injury of breaking my leg that sort of abruptly stole my autonomy and independence, and the physical pain and discomfort and sleepless nights, that I really sort of understood that I was struggling emotionally. But it almost felt like a cop-out. I could tell people that I was struggling because they could see the physical manifestations of the fractures. They could see that my leg was broken and understand, well, yeah, it makes sense to be struggling in that space, and still didn't have to disclose that my struggles were much more, you know, deeper than that. And so, you know, I continued on in this medical pathway of putting my needs on the back burner, of always wanting to be a healer, a helper, to help other people, but not addressing what I needed to do to be successful and happy in my own life. And at one point, you know, after doing that for year after year after year and getting through residency training and seeing death and dying and tragedy and suffering and all these complex emotional events and pushing them down deep and not processing them, it caught up to me. And it was early in oncology, working with children living with cancer, and sometimes, you know, taking care of patients that died from their cancers, that emotional strategy of just pushing it down, getting through, led to this space of brokenness where I turned to the bottle as my only means of escape, and did that in a way to treat the emotional pain I was feeling. And it worked. And I don't think we often talk about addiction in the space and the realm of that people are treating the pain in their life. And for me, that was the way that I treated pain. And it worked for a short amount of time until it quickly spiraled out of control. And in that spiraling, my depression got worse. I really was in active alcoholism and addiction, and reached a point where I was actively suicidal, because the alcohol no longer took away the pain, and I saw that that was sort of the ultimate way of being able to alleviate the pain and suffering in my life. And I also saw it as a way of relieving the burden of my presence from other people that I just inconvenienced, or that I was causing suffering to other people, that they wouldn't have to put up with me or tolerate me anymore. And so I saw it actually as a gift, as a selfless act, as one last thing I could do for other people. And, you know, it culminated in this moment of living in North Carolina at the time, of driving out to the woods and having an active plan to never come home. And the symbology, the metaphor, the imagery of the cover of the book and the story is, you know, taking those first few steps out of the woods on this long, beautiful, arduous, amazing, incredible, sometimes difficult, you know, walk out of the woods to find a new life. And I, you know, wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't have taken those steps now 8 years later into recovery if it wasn't for my wife, who's, for those of you who read the book, is really the heroine of the story, and my family and friends who stood up and continue to stand behind me today. And so, you know, a lot of the first part of the book is about that story, Into Darkness, but the hope part is writing and telling about the 8 years since that I've been able to reclaim my life and plant my feet on new ground and now raise a family, be in a happy marriage, have 2 young children, a 3rd on the way, and live a professional life that allows me to, you know, to speak about my truth, my authenticity, my journey in a way that's empowering and only makes me a better physician because of compassion and empathy and an understanding of what it's like to be sick myself. And so that's, you know, sort of what I write about in this story and, you know, what I hope that other people who are struggling can take away, that there is, you know, there is a path out and a way to a better future in life.
Wow, what a story. You know, I'm listening to share your journey. There's just, you know, lots of thoughts and questions. I want to go back to your early childhood. Have you looked more deeply? What were you aware of the, you know, what might have precipitated this disconnection with yourself that caused that insecurity? Have you looked at, you know, was it, I mean, you talked about having a loving family, but something triggered that disconnect early on. Could even be birth, you know. I've done a lot of work on birth trauma in my practice as a psychotherapist, and some of these wounds that we carry begin very early in life.
That's right. And, you know, it really, for me, I was, you know, I'm an introvert, a socially well-adjusted one now in my late 30s, but at the time I was a scrawny kid, shy, a little bit awkward. I was labeled a mama's boy, of having separation anxiety way late in elementary school before it was, you know, later than it was acceptable. And so I, you know, I stood out for being different as a kid who sat behind a piano in elementary school as opposed to coming out into a classroom of peers. And I, and so I think I, you know, in standing out, this sort of, when I sort of started to feel, you know, that other people didn't approve of that, or that I would be treated differently. And even with the physical bullying, and those memories remain for a long time of, you know, that my true self wasn't good enough, or that, you know, if I, you know, let out who I really was inside, that it would be judged or shamed. And so I think it was embedded in me from an early age that sort of to walk the line, to try to assimilate and fit in, to wear a mask, to, you know, play the role of who I was supposed to be so that I could fit in, out of a self-preservation mindset. And I think in different ways, and I'm not painting a picture that, you know, bullying alone caused me to be in recovery or in active addiction. I think that anybody's life story is complex. For me, it was just a piece of how I coped and how I adapted, and that, you know, what I experienced, that is a part of my story. And I think for a long time it delayed my ability to sort of reach out for help, because I didn't want to seem weak or different. And at least that's how I felt at the time.
You know, I see our culture as a culture that actually is an addicted culture. You know, if you do not find that place that you have finally arrived at through your journey of self-acceptance and self-love, then everything we do in our life is to fill that hole in our soul, that pain. I mean, I've seen it in my life. You know, you can become a workaholic. Mm-hmm. You can be a studyaholic, right? You can be an overachiever. You can use alcohol. You can use anything. Anything can become a way to ameliorate pain. Anything, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, people do some weird things that they have found somehow to build those feel-good neurochemicals that can help us cope. But it's a journey of, I kind of see it as the human story of how we get disconnected from our true self, and then the many unique and creative ways our soul takes us back to the connection and to the purpose and to the compassion. It's a fascinating story of humanity, I think. And what are your thoughts?
No, I agree. And really, you know, the epiphany for me, this moment, I'd been in recovery for 3 or 4 years, but I still was living a secret double life of trying to cope with my shame and feeling different. I'd been successful in recovery, but I'd still ostracized and self-stigmatized myself. And this epiphany moment was, unfortunately, came out of losing a colleague to suicide. And it was actually, at the time, the fifth colleague I had lost to suicide in my career. And sitting in those moments, in those spaces, and comforting other people in their grief and in their loss, I had this moment of self-acceptance and acknowledging my authenticity and my story and the power of it, that maybe my experience can help heal other people who've been in a similar walk. And, you know, that was 3.5 years ago, and that was really the moment of healing, that I accepted myself, loved myself, can have self-compassion, that I've been on, you know, this journey, this experience that has had difficult times, but all of those have made me into the person I am today. And really that moment in that space was when true healing began, even though I'd started a therapeutic path 3 or 4 years before. And I think there's so much power in that.
So how did that moment happen, Adam? What happened that, I mean, it's, you know, it's the journey of realizing that we need healing, we need help. And whether it's, you know, going to therapy or something that is supporting us in staying sober to ourselves. But that's you know, that's a kind of a, I don't know, it's more, you know, a mental process, I would say. You know, it's understanding and talking, but that's not where the real transformation happens. Something else has to occur, even by the grace of God, some spontaneous awakening. How did that happen for you?
I think it really was a culmination of several different events. And one was, you know, being in a recovery meeting and sitting next to a man, and I write about in the book, with 40 plus years of recovery, who thanked me for being there today. And I was, you know, very young, very fresh into recovery, and said, you know, by you being here today, you've helped to keep me sober. And it always stuck with me, like, that here was somebody who didn't know me, didn't know my journey, didn't know my experience, who didn't really know me as a human at all, who was grateful for me being there, and that, you know, my story could have a power to help other people. And it was in that I knew that I had to give it away, and had to give away what I had experienced to other people, for one, you know, to help my own healing and recovery, but also that there's a power in the story that could impact somebody else. The second moment was seeing the delirium, or the effects of stigma every day, in our culture and seeing how it prevents people who need help from getting the help that they deserve. And I see that all the time in my professional worlds, but see it all the time in the patients and families I care for as well, that, you know, and so here are, I had experienced institutional stigmatization, self-stigmatization, the stigma of a culture at large as well. And so maybe with the platform that I have, I can use my voice and add it to a movement to combat that stigma. And so sort of taking, you know, those couple lessons that there's a power in the story, I can use this story to combat stigma, and using that voice to make a difference in other people's lives, I think led to this new opportunity to, you know, be very open, vulnerable, but authentic, and in itself create this path of healing.
And we're talking about a path of healing. And when we talk about the medical profession, as you were saying, you know, you went in there studying, trying to be the brightest and have a, you know, be recognized for being so smart, having the grasp of this knowledge, putting 16, 18 hours a day of studying into what is really the healing arts, right? The healing arts. You're in a healing profession. And you can be bright, you can be clever, you can name things, but that isn't healing. And, you know, your patients are very fortunate to have you, Anam, because when you come from a true place of self-love, that's where you can access compassion. That's where you can be there present with your heart open. And that, in my experience, is the true gift of a healer. And, you know, I would put you in that category of a healer. I wouldn't put doctors, per se, in the category of healers. They're good technicians. When you have this gift now that you see the dark side of your soul and you had to go through the lessons and learning and be driven by the pain to find who you really are and come out of the darkness, you are such a gift to your profession and to your patients.
Well, I appreciate that kindness, and that means a lot. I found, you know, for me, there's so much more meaning and purpose in the work that you allude to now, of being able to find a connection that's deeper than lab studies or diagnoses or what image we're going to order next, right? That this is how we relate to each other in a really human way that is so much deeper and actually dramatically affects, improves the, you know, the quality of the care that we provide to patients in the medical system, is that, you know, you really care and you really create a space for vulnerability and authenticity and honest communication between patient and doctor, then I think it opens up so many opportunities to let true healing happen. And that's what I found. It's my story's only, well, having lived through my story has only, I think, made me more accessible and more open in a way that that hopefully helps.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, an open heart is such a healing energy. Can you share a little bit about how you're different in your relationship with your patients? I mean, you've chosen, you know, pediatric oncology, palliative care. I mean, these are such, you know, emotionally, you know, deep emotional areas of a lot of suffering and pain. And here you are being able to be a, you know, a healing presence in that field. But boy, that's not an easy specialty to choose.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the gift of the work is that there are so many opportunities to make a difference in somebody's life who's really immensely struggling and suffering. And, you know, to use those tools of lived experience in a space where there's a lot of opportunity. It is difficult work. It's emotional work, you know, and you have to continue to to check in with yourself, your colleagues, and people you work with to process it in a healthy emotional way. But I've always seen it as that there's so many spaces for impact that I can't, you know, I adopt an external locus of control, that there's a lot of things that are beyond my influence or control. But if I can only stand in the face of sadness, of tragedy, and make even a small difference, then it's a good day. And it's worth waking up and doing that all over again. And so, you know, as I take care of a family and a patient who may be going through a cancer diagnosis, or even a patient who, you know, may not survive their diagnosis, helping them to live the best day possible every single day, and having the ability to do that and walk with them to be patient and present in that, to me, means something and gives me a greater purpose to do this work and to continue to do this work.
Yeah, I think from the place you live in now, you really see the miracles on a daily basis, and you just can have such deep connections that are those healing connections that we were talking about. So, you know, out of your experience, Adam, what would you offer as guidance to people who are struggling with addictions?
I think the guidance that I offer, one, is that, you know, I've been in a space of denial and blaming everybody else and in my world for what I was going through, and really had to reach a space where of holding out my hand and saying, I can't do this alone. And fortunately for me, I had, you know, people there to grab my hand and to help, you know, get me connected into recovery. And so I try to encourage people that, you know, it can be difficult. The first few days, weeks, months of recovery are hard work. But at the same time, you know, try to reach out your hand and take that next step and just try to do one thing at a time, and the rewards can be immense. And if you sort of just keep working the process and do the next right thing, and there's incredible hope. I could have never even begun to imagine or to tell you the life I live now, you know, 8 years in. It's just incredible. There's just so much joy and gifts on a daily basis when you live in gratitude for every single day. And even, you know, in my late teens, early 20s, before I was struggling in active addiction, compare those days to now, and I wouldn't trade anything. I just think that there's just so many blessings of a life in recovery, and that's promised to each and every one of you, too, who's struggling. Take a day at a time and a step at a time.
So the first step would be to acknowledge that there is a problem, that you aren't actually living you're not living from an authentic place, that there's a pain there, and that you're anesthetizing yourself in some way. Is that the first step? Just coming to that realization,
yeah,
and the problem?
I think so. And acknowledging what you've been doing obviously isn't working, and maybe there's a better way. And then allowing other people to help show you what that better way looks like. And whether that's in therapy, in loved ones, family members, in recovery communities, but to open yourself up to, you know, another person's opinion and helping hand, and I think that those are the first steps.
So you went to AA. Is that the community that you reached out to?
I did. You know, my my recovery community was, you know, with a therapist, a psychiatrist, and AA is sort of where I, you know, found my recovery, and a combination of the three, because I concurrently needed to be treated, you know, medically treated for depression and anxiety, And I was, but the community building, I think, was one of the most important things. And so, a combination of those is what worked for me, and slowly building my circles of support over time. It was my wife, my parents up front, and a few colleagues. And, now I can say I have a community of support all over the world, and everybody that hears my story or that I get to share my testimony with are part of that, and I'm part of theirs too when they trust in me, and that's an incredible thing.
Did you work with nutrition? Did you work with balancing neurotransmitters? Did you get to that piece of that process? As a traditional medical doctor.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe not on the micro level that you're alluding to, but definitely in that, my physical health has been one of my highest priorities. I run and work out every day and, stay and I'm at 39 years of age. I'll be 40 later this year. I'm in the best physical shape of my life. So diet and exercise have been critical to, to my overall success, and coupling that with, mindfulness and meditation and finding ways to really keep my emotional headspace in check too, is all of those have been critically important.
Yeah, well, thanks for sharing that, because I think we have to work on all levels if we're dealing with the pain that we carry of not good enough, of not worthy, of shame, of guilt, whatever what goes on in the human condition, that it's also a biochemical response. It's, an emotional response. It's a spiritual, urge that is driving us to understand ourselves. But it's like a holistic approach. I know for me, because I used to suffer when I was younger with a lot of depression as well. And, it's looking for what's going to help. What's going to help me? And I guess it was, I don't know. First of all, I had to get my thyroid functioning better, because I think I had a thyroid imbalance for a really long time. And that actually, when you're hypothyroid, depression is a side effect. It's a symptom.
That's right.
Of a sluggish thyroid, right? So, it's the journey of untangling this web, right, that's manifesting in these symptoms. But there are things driving it, and there are things that can help restore a sense of well-being. Do you have any thoughts about that, Adam?
No, I agree. And, you speak to the nature of a holistic approach, and I completely agree with that. And so, having follow-ups and routine and things with my doctor to check the levels and things you talked about, yes, we're part of that. I also think, it's even larger than that. You speak about the spiritual piece. You speak about, I write in the opening page of this book that, I'm a upper middle class white American male too, and have come from and have that privilege of a professional platform. And so I would be remiss if I didn't talk about the fact that financial toxicities and the strains and stressors and lack of community resources and mental health resources and access to these treatment modalities that we talk about are just, there's a paucity of these services, especially in small towns and communities across this country that people can't access. And I think that's a tragedy. And part of this epidemic of suicide that we see across this country is that, we really have to address holistically mental health in a way that and fund it in this country in a way that says that we see this epidemic and we're going to do something substantial about it.
Yeah, we live in a culture that actually supports our addictions, right? So television. We can watch all the television, we can watch, the politics, we can I mean, some of the areas that I've been researching, just being on a computer, just being in a blue lit room, and certainly as a physician, you're in a blue lit environment all the time, suppresses dopamine levels, increases addictions. I mean, everything about the environment that we've created, this artificial, indoor, mechanistic, high tech world, high tech food world, everything that's artificial actually is contributing to our disconnection from ourselves. And it's the awakening process of starting to reconnect again to ourselves, reconnect to nature, getting outdoors, natural sunlight, reconnecting with natural foods, reconnecting with other people. This is the journey we're on to reconnect to what I would call our true self. It's getting more challenging as well.
It is, in the fast paced way of the modern expectations that are rapidly changing of who you're supposed to be and of perfectionism and of social media world, right? And I think that it's just isolated us further and further away, not only from our true selves, but quite tangibly from each other. And I think that is a piece of this story, of my story, of a lot of people's stories who struggle with their mental health, is that we've created a system that actually has indoctrinated and embeds us in our own isolation. And I hope we continue to find ways to break that down.
Yeah, I would say people really need to get away from processed food, sugar foods. We know that that creates depression. I mean, alcohol is definitely a depressant. We need to get outside sometimes, from exercising, getting healthy. There's some great work that's being done with the use of neurotransmitters and balancing our brain again naturally, so we have balance of serotonin and dopamine and all those key neurotransmitters. Meditation, I think, is profound. Meditation, the research is showing it's changing our brain. We can rebalance our brain through meditation and being in a loving community. We have so many resources now as we get more, become more awakened to the journey back to ourselves. Back to ourselves. I mean, we can be really radical, and I've been doing experiences with plant medicine and working with these ancient healing modalities and seeing miracles, people healing from addiction as well. The answers are there. We just have to take that first step, I guess.
Yeah, no, I was set outside yesterday. It was we're in winter here in Indiana, but it was 53 degrees and sunshine. And so I sat out on my back deck yesterday and just soaked in the sun and did some reading. And it was better than anything else I could have done, just to get outside and some fresh air. And definitely believe in the healing power of that.
Yes, absolutely. So what do you see as your mission at this point in your life, Adam? What are you doing to further your real, I would call your greater purpose, your greater calling?
Yeah, I try to stay grounded in being the best husband and father that I can be, as well as son and brother first, and keeping those priorities in line on a daily basis, that acknowledge those are the most important pieces of who I am and of my life. But at the same time, acknowledging this piece of my life in a way that hopefully can make a difference and an impact, and by telling my mental health and addiction story. And I hope that, especially in a time where there is this epidemic of suicide and untreated mental health conditions and barriers and obstacles in the way, whether it's stigma or policy or lack of resources, that, I hope to just to be one small voice and to add that to what I feel is this growing movement and in the last handful of years of people willing to speak up about their experience in a way that hopefully normalizes the conversation that, you know, so many people have lived experience, and for the vast majority of people, that lived experience, you know, empowers them to be who they are today because they've lived through it. And it's not weakness or moral failing or, you know, some sort of affliction that's about your character. These are medical conditions that affect so many people. And let's talk about the conversation in a way that reflects that. And so I hope to continue to be able to do that and spread the message of recovery and hope, and how it's, you know, for me, just made me a more empathic and compassionate person with a deeper understanding of what it means to be human, and try to use that in any way I can to connect to other people.
And what about bringing this message to your profession, to the doctors, to the nurses? What, I mean, you were ostracized for a long time when it was found in your, you know, history that you had addiction issues. And I know in reading your book, you had, you know, certain jobs denied to you because of that. So now what are you doing to support your profession in acknowledging this and dealing with their own issues and supporting other people?
Yeah, so you're right. You know, part of my experience was, you know, my license being put on probation for simply coming forth and voluntarily disclosing that I was successful in recovery. I had job opportunities that I did not get because of being in recovery. And the truth is, all of those things happened for a reason for me and my story, and it led me to be where I am today. And but I think it's led me to a space to see that there's systemic injustices, there's institutional stigma, there's policies that need to be reformed, and just the ways that we've approached mental health within our own and how we've treated our own, it sends a terrible message to the communities that we serve all the time, that if we're going to judge, shame, punish individuals because of their mental health or addiction stories, then why would people come forth and honestly, openly accept, you know, treatment from the same people who are ostracizing themselves? And so, fortunately, you know, I've been privileged to be a part of some policy reformations and looking and rewriting policy and talking about, you know, mental health as a medical condition, addiction as a medical condition that needs medical treatment, as opposed to like punishment, shame, termination of employment, and really giving people the opportunity to seek those. And, you know, also worked hard to be a part of grassroots movements of just telling people stories. We, you know, host these events called Compassion Rounds at our hospital that I started about a year and a half ago, where we just tell human stories of our experiences and in a forum of 300 people. And it's this storytelling event, but it's really meant to attract people to a message that they may identify with, of, hey, that person up on the stage is talking about their experience of being a survivor of PTSD or sexual abuse or addiction recovery. And so now I know that that person's somebody safe that I can go talk to within my own story. And so we've tried to build these safe spaces for vulnerability and normalize things like treatment by building programs of opt-out counseling that everybody sort of in the medical training facility that I work has a counseling session scheduled, actually two of them per year. And you can go or you cannot go, but it just normalizes this way that somebody can walk past in the hallway and say, hey, I'm going to my counseling session. Yeah, me too. I have mine next Thursday, as opposed to what we've done for so long is shame and hide away that, you know, you're going to a therapist or have mental illness in quotation marks as it's ascribed, but just that this is a normal part of practicing in a field where you see really difficult things on a daily basis. And so try to build some things like that, and I'll continue to do that in a way that just normalizes our stories.
Well, that's such powerful That's such a powerful contribution, Adam. That's just beautiful to hear that you're actually bringing something of real change, transformation into heart, into a system that is often very powerless or disconnected, parts because they have to be because of what they see on a daily basis. But creating that safe space for people to support each other and heal and talk about experiences that are so emotionally impacting, right? That's a human experience. We need that. We need that in all our workplaces. And so that's just beautiful. And the other thing I want to acknowledge you for, and what I hear so many people saying when they've gone through the dark night of the soul and been able to go in and reach that place of peace and healing, they are grateful for every single experience they've ever had in their life. They're grateful for the pain. They're grateful for the trauma because without all those experiences, they couldn't arrive at this very moment of peace and healing. That's such a powerful place to arrive at, that total gratitude for everything you have ever been through, because without it, we couldn't be right here, right now.
That's right. I mean, you said it beautifully, and I agree with that. And that's the space I try to work from on a daily basis. I'm still a flawed human being. I have setbacks, failures every single day. I make mistakes. I, continue to work on myself. But I try to make peace with that and have gratitude for this moment, this day, and everything that I've been gifted.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful way to complete our conversation, and I so appreciate your honesty and openness. And boy, you're the kind of doctor I want to have. I don't need doctors, because it's that healing relationship that's the most critical piece of the healing process. And to have someone sit with compassion and an open heart is the greatest healing energy you can have. So. The patients are very fortunate to have you, Adam. And as you get out there and your platform grows, you have such a mission. So it's just beautiful to have this time with you. And I want people to know, if they want to find out more about you, they should go to your website, which is adamhillmd.com, adamhill.md.com. And certainly, I encourage everyone to pick up Adam's new book, which has just been out the last couple of months, called Long Walk Out of the Woods, A Physician's Story of Addiction, Depression, Hope, and Recovery. It's an inspirational book. It's a great read. You've done a great job on writing that book, Adam. And most of all, it's a book that offers real hope, real transformation, real light in a person's life. So Long Walk Out of the Woods, Dr. Adam Hill. It's such a pleasure to have talked with you today. Thank you so much for the great work you're doing and the great work you'll be doing in years ahead, no doubt.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you today.
You're so welcome. And to all of my wonderful listeners, thank you for joining me here on The Love Code every Saturday. And I want you to know, if you go to my Facebook page, Cheryl Fellman, S-A-T-R-R-I-L-L. I always have to spell my first name, Cheryl Fellman. If you go to that Facebook page, all of my podcasts are posted there every week. I have a second one on Progressive Radio Network called What Women Must Know. Or you can go to my website, Dr. Cheryl Fellman, drcherylfellman.com, and opt in there, and all those shows will be sent to you every week. So either way, stay connected, keep listening, keep sharing all the love and all the wisdom, and fill your week with love, peace, and harmony. Bye for now.